You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 51 is something like, what is language? And we read a few things. Ferdinand de Saussure's Course in General Linguistics, published in 1916, Part 1 and Part 2, Chapter 4. Claude Lévi-Strauss's The Structural Study of Myth from 1955. And Jacques Derrida's essay, Structure, Sign, and Play in the Discourse of the Human Sciences from 1966. You can get links to online versions of all these texts, discussion of this episode, and much, much more at partiallyexaminedlife.com. My name is Mark Linton-Meyer in Free Play from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Owen in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, linguistically in Middleton, Wisconsin.
This is Derek Varn as a signifier in Seoul, South Korea.
You're actually in Seoul, South Korea right now?
Oh, no, I'm actually in Atlanta, but I'm normally in Seoul, South Korea.
Ah, so Sare in Seoul, South Korea, Estar in...
Correct.
The limitations of English.
Yeah.
And Seth, he got a hold of me a couple days ago, and he's like, oh, I thought it was next Sunday. Oh, man. Can I read all the stuff in 2 days? You could try.
That's brave.
Well, it was short enough to read 2 hours.
You read the Derrida in a few hours? I had some trouble with that.
9 pages, right? Yeah.
It's 9 pages that you read over and over and over again.
If you're a masochist.
Hey, before we meet Derek, we should say this podcast is largely listener supported. So we've had a bunch of people since last recording that have contributed large sums, including Steve Peterschmidt, Laura Rankin, Sean Dion, Eric Johnson, Robinson Kuntz, Michael Harlow, Philip Carroll, Brian Jasper, Robert Leventer, Chris Buckner, Andrew Norman, and Andrew Galeen. Thanks also to the several others that sent $1, $3, $5. That's all great. We've been suggesting a $1 minimum donation if you like this episode. Or just go to the website. There are lots of things for sale there. Another way to support us is by supporting our sponsor for this episode, which is Audible. Why, that's the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of millions of thousands of many audiobooks in electronic form. They've got over 100,000 titles to choose from in any genre. Although that makes me think, I mean, do they really have like sadomasochistic self-help and that kind of, I mean, is it really every, anyway, go to audiblepodcast.com/PEL and folks in the US and Canada can get a free audiobook. For instance, you could search postmodernism, which is kind of what this episode is about, and find some titles related to exactly what we're talking about. Our next episode is going to be on philosophy and race. You can find books there by the authors we'll be covering: Cornel West, Martin Luther King, W.E.B. Du Bois. We've also decided to do an episode pretty soon where we'll give a philosophical discussion of Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men. So you could get that in abridged or unabridged edition. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/PEL.
There's an abridged version of No Country for Old Men?
Isn't it really short? I think it's a lot. The abridgment is like 2 hours long. And then they all die.
Oh, because it's audio. So they're paying us for sarcastic commercials?
I've heard Audible done on many other podcasts, and yes, they seem to have a high tolerance. Okay. Who are you, stranger? C. Derek?
I am a poet and university lecturer in Seoul, South Korea. I work at Hankukwede Daehakyo, or Hankuk University of Foreign Studies, as a lecturer in American culture, intercultural communications, and English as a second language.
Do you lecture in Korean or in English?
I lecture in a mixture of both, primarily in English. My Korean is not terribly good.
A lot of sign language, gestures.
Yeah, a lot of Hanguk Jeon Muteo, which is just me saying I speak very bad Korean.
Ah. I was going to say, that's a very focused joke there.
Yeah. I can say I speak very bad Korean and very good Korean, which is sort of unfortunate, since that usually leads to conversations. But anyway, I primarily work in linguistics, although that's not my background. My background is poetry and analytic philosophy.
And yet you seem to be one of those guys that is chased around the offensive part of the continental tradition, which is what we're looking into right now.
I am both fascinated by and hostile to postmodernism, but I'm actually hostile to it from like a sympathetic viewpoint. I find a lot of the analytic critiques of postmodernity actually kind of flaccid.
Because they just don't read, right? They just don't have no tolerance for the style. And
yeah, it seems actually almost like it's a stylistic, just not dealing with the concepts at hand. To really dig into any kind of continental philosophy past Heidegger, you have to deal with structuralism.
And I know we barely got West to do this one.
We did?
I thought you were against this topic in general.
I'm not against it. And because I've studied psychoanalysis, I've had to read this Saussure many times, and I've read a lot of Lacan. And yes, I hate Lacan with a passion, but there are some important ideas there, so yeah.
Do you blame Saussure for Lacan?
No, I think Saussure did his own thing, and it's very insightful. And I think, you know, the structuralists and post-structuralists did their own thing with Saussure. They're not just taking it whole cloth. They're making their modifications. So some would criticize the way they've interpreted or adapted Saussure, and some will defend that. But Saussure himself, I have no problem with.
I was not familiar with this story at all. So if you look at a lot of recent continental philosophy, what seems objectionable in the style, what I find hard to read, I've been trying to trace sort of where this goes back to. And I know some of it is in Levinas, who talks about the other with, you know, a capital O. And some of it is back to Heidegger and folks that we've read already. But Saussure gets a lot of this as well. And he's not somebody that was even offered to me as an option in grad school, because it seems like this particular strain, like I listened to part of a iTunes U lecture series from Yale to prep for this, a couple lectures by an English prof. I'll link to this on the website, as just part of a criticism of literature, right? So it seems a lot of people that are not in philosophy read this stuff. And postmodernism had a relatively short, at least by the time we got to grad school, it was already like very much coming out of favor. But in other departments, this stuff is still very top of mind.
Yes, yeah, sociology departments as well.
Oh, yeah. When I was getting my master's of fine arts and poetry, I had to read all this almost in every class. That's how I became familiar with it, actually, was just having to go through and read all the continental philosophers as if it was literary criticism. And that includes Lacan and people who really aren't doing anything related to literary criticism. So they just get used that way.
Right. Dylan, did you have any of this stuff?
I'd read some Derrida in undergrad, but never read any Saussure, never even heard of the guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Derrida sort of has a wide enough scope that any overview philosophy course, you should do hopefully some Derrida, or at least you get to mention, even if only to be dismissed as a fad or something like that. But, and this is not, should not be considered sort of the Derrida episode. We're not going to talk about deconstruction. This is really just about this particular story where Saussure is just a linguist. And in fact, he's not even, from what I read on Wikipedia anyway, his approach to linguistics has largely been discredited itself, that Chomsky and people following Chomsky just think that it's not an adequate system for dealing with the whole of what you want to do with linguistics. But I know almost nothing about that. This certainly had no overlap with what I had in my undergrad linguistics course. But in any case, just the idea of the relationship between thought and language or something that he came up with, extremely influential and got generalized by guys like Levi-Strauss into this thing called structuralism, which then apparently was very hip for about 2 years. And then this exact Jacques Derrida essay, he actually presented at a conference in 1966 in Baltimore that was supposed to sort of coronate Levi-Strauss, and Levi-Strauss was at it. And even though this essay seems like a lot of it, I mean, it's talking about Levi-Strauss, and he's even quotes Levi-Strauss a lot to make his own points, but it was perceived and sort of historically came down to as the dethroning of the Levi-Strauss and the structuralist, strictly structuralist approach, right?
Yeah, it was sort of a big flip because this conference at Johns Hopkins was supposed to bring it all together. It was really the first introduction to structuralism in the United States in a big way. And when it happened, this essay just sort of blew it out of water as soon as it began. Structuralism actually really comes back into importance in American continental theory through Marxism, because you have a lot of French Marxists who are highly influenced by structuralism as a sort of counter tradition to postmodernism, but it pretty much started dead in the water in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, linguistically, it's sort of discredited for two reasons. One is Chomsky's natural grammar, and the other is the idea that the structure of language produces thought itself has largely been abandoned. There's a Steven Pinker book about it, which is itself controversial, but has pretty much the given thing for most linguists I know is that language and thought are not exactly coterminous. And so language does not just generate thought. And Saussure sort of predicated that thought was almost a byproduct of language.
We want to make sure that we don't get completely lost in the first of these three texts. So maybe we should give a little more detailed overview of the three and then jump into some of the specifics.
I was going to make two pleas along those regards. To the extent that the Derrida is a kind of critique of the Saussure and Levi-Strauss, maybe we could really make sure we try to articulate what they're saying before we try to say that they're wrong, or at least say that Derrida says they're wrong. And then as a little bit of not an aside, but I don't know enough about the naming convention in the history of philosophy. I'm wondering if in the terms of structuralism that Derek, you've heard of, or maybe you guys have heard of, the way it's used in philosophy of science for like structural realism. I mean, there's things about the way it's used there that resonate with what I hear out of the Saussure, but I didn't know if there was any sort of principle cross-fertilization.
You know, I actually looked a little bit at structural realism just because when I was doing secondary literature research for this. Do you want to say what that is in philosophy of science?
Well, I mean, it's going to be a lot like the Saussure in that you're going to say that what you find out are differences in relations in the world. But the big deal is that you're going to say that those differences that you find, even if you call them by variety of names, point to something that's real in the world.
So it's about the status of scientific objects or really models. So when we talk about an atom, for instance, the question is, do we naively think there's such a thing that looks just like the atom? And of course not. But that doesn't lead us to a complete skepticism about entities called atoms. We just think of them as having, it's the structural, it's the relations that they provide us with that we can think of as real, regardless of, is that the best way of putting it, but it's...
Yeah, and so what you come down to is trying to, rather than getting in a conflict about whether or not atoms actually exist, you insist that your scientific enterprise does get at the world and at real things, and that you learn real things about the world. And what you end up saying is you learn some structural things, so to speak.
Yeah. So whatever the terms of the relations end up being or looking like, if that's even meaningful, we know that the relations are something of which we have knowledge. The terms of those relations could vary as we like, but it's that structural thing. It's those relationships that are the constant thing that we gain knowledge of.
Yes. And it's out of there that you would begin speaking about things like meaning. And the controversies are going to be things like whether your terminology refers or not and what it refers to exactly. And I see hints of that in here between the Saussure and the Levi-Strauss, the way Levi-Strauss does the analysis of the mythology and uses that to say, well, the structure that's there, the thing that's real that you learn, that's true and eternal, maybe that's saying it too strongly, comes out of that structural analysis and the kind of comparative difference.
Yeah, I think it's related because the value of signs is going to depend on every other sign within the system, right?
Yeah.
So it's largely relational, or that's not exactly accurate the way I put it, actually, because he does end up saying that there's a positive. But maybe we should back up and let's get at his basic theory.
I think, I mean, you gave the key point in characterizing his system. What he's reacting to is that linguists before him were just looking seemingly at historical changes in language, right? Looking how Latin relates to French and trying to say things about that. So his big critique, Saussure's, and this 1916 book was actually put together after his death by a bunch of his students. So it's actually just their lecture notes on him. And he was preaching that people should draw a very sharp distinction between this history of the language, which he called, a diachronic explanation?
Yeah, diachronic explanation or parole.
Yeah. And then a synchronic explanation, which is looking at just an analysis of the language at a time. You can think of, all right, well, if we're going to forget about how the language got this way, well, we could look at the parts of speech as we use them now. We could look at the syntax in this particular language at this particular time. What is the subject-verb ordering and stuff like that? So there's a lot of things that should strike us as not that strange. I mean, can you characterize, before we sort of give what's philosophically weird about this, what else, Derek? It seems like you're more familiar with this book as a whole.
There's a lot of interesting stuff in it when you really dig into it. Particularly the idea that if you follow this out, that thoughts are actually a product of particular structures outside of time. And other thinkers do more with this philosophically, because Saussure wasn't really concerned about philosophy. If anything, actually, he was sort of opposed to it. He wanted to sort of deontologize and de-epistemologize the discussion of language, as well as sort of, you know, make it more than just the study of etymology or whatever. people like Althusser and Levi-Strauss sort of run with that, and you see them talking about ahistorical structures and histories without subjects and stuff. So it has some pretty big implications. But I don't think Saussure actually thought of his system that way. I think he was just primarily concerned with figuring out what a sign and signifier was.
Yeah.
That's a much more complicated question than it seems.
We should say what signifier and signified are and why he's making that distinction. Right. One of his motivations for doing this is he's objecting to the idea that it's sort of a common sense idea of language where we have a bunch of words and we came up with those words because there are a bunch of things in the world that we need to name. So that's precisely what he's objecting to. First of all, we don't get the simple relationship between a word and a thing, right? We come up with this new way of thinking about what a sign is.
Yeah.
A sign is this, consists of the signifier and signified, where the signifier is what he calls the sound image, and then the signified is a concept, basically.
Right.
So the signifier, the sound tree, the signifier isn't just the particular sound any person makes when they say tree. That's why he calls it sound image, right? Tree is something that sounds slightly different every time I say it. And of course, it'll vary across regional dialects. It's not that actual instance. So you want to think of that as sort of a schema. Whatever schema allows us to hear the same thing anytime someone says tree in an infinite number of different ways, that's the sound image and that's the signifier. And that's signifies this concept, and together they make up the sign, the thing with a meaning.
Right. So you have the sound image and the signified, which is a concept. But the concept isn't quite even necessarily the concept of the thing. For example, you can think about the way the term tree may change. So we might talk about a tree as a living thing made of wood outside, or we might talk about a tree as a conceptual map that has branches. And we know that in language through context somehow. And there is a relationship there. The signified relationship is not arbitrary, but as to exactly how that holds together, it's not entirely clear.
Yeah, it's arbitrary in the sense that we can use any sound we want.
Right.
Well, in one sense, we can use any sound we want, right, to designate the concept or to signify the concept tree. On the other hand, we can't. If we really want to communicate with others, we're bound by these conventions. So it's arbitrary on a grand scale, but it's not arbitrary for any particular speaker.
Yeah, it's not arbitrary in the instance, it's arbitrary in the origination.
Yeah, he talks about this in chapter 2 of part 1 a lot, invariability and variability of the sign. When I was reading it, I kept on making a note to myself about evolution, and then he started using the word evolution all the time and very explicitly. And it reminded me almost exactly of the problem of speciation and inheritance.
Yeah.
The invariability has to do with this kind of inheritance that goes from one thing to the other, but there's an arbitrariness about what exactly that is. And then over time, it can change subtly, and you might only see that difference in biological evolution. It might be over many, many generations that you see that, oh, actually, human beings and trees are just distant cousins. That's the implication of Darwin, right? I mean, forget the apes, right?
Yeah, so where the arbitrariness corresponds to mutation.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah, but that would all be diachronic discussion of language. Like, you have to deal with that, but it's also trying to move away from that because he seems to profoundly think that this misses a lot of the way that language actually functions and how we use it. Because I can talk about the relationship between, say, anima, animus, animal, all relating back to Latin. And so the animus would be the anger I feel. The anima would be what animates me, and the animal will be an animated thing. And we can all see that diachronically, but we're still missing something about the way language is actually functioning. And that would be his primary point.
Yeah, so which is to say there's this system, there's the level of, and I'm not sure what the pronunciation is. Is it langue? Lang or lang?
There's lang, langue, and poro. So like lang is the structure, syntax, semiotics. Parole is like the evolution of language, or the relationship of languages, and langue, French speakers are going to kill me, but langue is like human speech in the instance of using it. So like me talking right now. So you have that sort of tripartite distinction. And language is not really important.
I thought that was parole.
See, I had, parole.
The big distinction is parole and lang.
Yeah, where parole is the everyday, the actual speech of human beings. And then there's a sort of a middle level of languages, right? There's English as a language, French as a language, and then lang, if that's the correct pronunciation.
Yeah. Spelled langue.
Is it langue?
That's the spelling. I'm just telling the listeners.
God, I should have looked this up. But it's is the most general level where you're talking about what language is in general. And it's the system of language. And it's something that sort of is common to all different languages, all the different instances of language. And so that's the proper, that's what linguistics is actually studying, this very general level. That's what you're saying, Derek, with going against the diachronic, where you're not just documenting historical changes, but you're looking at what language is at this very abstract level.
Right.
No, I think, though, it has to be referred to a specific language. What I got out of Wikipedia for langue versus parole was langue referring to the abstract system of language that is internalized by a given speech community. It's not language overall in general by everyone, the deep structure of it. It's the structure of this particular language at this time, which is the thing that he's talking about in this book.
Right. Well, that's actually, I think, one of the things that distinguishes Saussure from Chomsky. And for example, is Chomsky talks about like universal language structures, and Saussure just doesn't really think those exist. He thinks that all languages would be like syntax of specific instances of specific communities.
Right.
He seems to want to get rid of or downplay any kind of teleological notion at all that would go along with a study of linguistics. And the idea would be that there's nothing about our language that is going towards anything in particular.
Correct.
As opposed to somebody who says our language reveals something about its deep origins in itself, that it points back towards some authentic beginning of different kinds. I'm kind of explicitly using a similar kind of discussion and critique that you have of biological evolution about, on the one hand, there's nothing about our speciation that points back towards anything natural in their kinds. Those kinds develop, those kinds are differences, but they aren't anything natural. And it seems to me Saussure would be of that bent. And that would be something like what he means by the arbitrariness of our language. It's founded on difference, yes. Those differences aren't rooted in any natural cleavings of the world.
So the way I was taught this is he was trying to deontologize the study of language.
Yes. I don't want to get deep into kind of criticism of that right away, but those differences, while arbitrary, the question will be to the extent of which they're real, in which they point to something actual and provide meaning and purchase on the world. So it might be the case that there's something arbitrary about the way in which you separate a tree out from the ground. But it's another question altogether to say that once done, that you've not pointed to anything that's to an actual object, for instance.
I think he's actually bracketing that out. The question of the extent to which the real world, whatever that is affecting the way the sort of stream of sound and then the conceptual stream that he describes them, the way they get carved up into signs through difference, right, at least on each level. Signs become positive things in themselves, but at the level signifier and signified, each thing has its value simply through its differential relation to other signifiers and other signifieds. And that does sound like, and I think in the way that Saussure is used, that'll end up seeming as if it implies a kind of relativism, because he's not even talking about objects, right? The signified is the concept. And it seems as if there's just some sort of arbitrary carving up into signs without regard to whether or not there are natural kinds in the world to which signs are related in some way. Although the one thing that he's, I think, certain of is that language isn't simply a system of words that have come about as a way of naming obvious entities in the world. Those entities aren't entities as such until there's a system of language. The ability to conceptualize those things comes about with language and with a system of differences. They're not simply there beforehand and then language is overlaid on top of it. But that doesn't imply that the world couldn't play a role in the development of this system of differences. Now, I think people who make use of Saussure, some of them will take the relativist line and will say there is no world, let's say, outside of the text, or that it is a completely arbitrary, in the second sense of arbitrary, development
Right. Well, this is where it's important to just remind ourselves that Saussure did not remotely see himself as a philosopher, and his influence on philosophy is almost historical accident. Really, all these questions for him were just methodological.
Right. Well, he is talking about thought. So I have the quote here. It's this is in part 2, chapter 4, section 1 there, second paragraph, linguistic value. Psychologically, setting aside its expression in words, our thought is simply a vague, shapeless mass. Philosophers and linguists have always agreed that if it were not for signs, you should be incapable of differentiating any two ideas in a clear and constant way. In itself, thought is like a swirling cloud where no shape is intrinsically determinate. No ideas are established in advance, and nothing is distinct before the introduction of linguistic structure. So that's the key point. And then he goes on to say the same thing is true of sound. So it's not like what is going to count as a word. You could have whistles, you could have multi-syllable thing, all be one word. You could have, think of when people try to create alien languages in movies and things, like that series of clicks and whistles and beeps that R2-D2 or whatever is making. You know, which are the words in there?
Yeah, listen to a foreign language and try and say, what are the phonological units in that? And it's difficult. So you have this stream, A and B, and they're each this amorphous stream. And it's only in getting paired up with each other that you actually get units, which I think is an ingenious idea.
He's also saying that the very making of the unit is arbitrary, right?
Well, I think he's bracketing that question, actually.
I think that he might want to bracket it, but he's clearly at least talking about it even if he doesn't want to. If you're going to say that about language, it's exactly the same thing that you're talking about when you say, I'm going to distinguish the leaf on the tree from the leaf. I'm going to distinguish the leg on the chair from the leg, or the grain of sand from the bucket of sand. How do I distinguish, pick out the one unit thing out of the whole? And lo and behold, I'll also look at that one unit thing and I'll find another unit thing. And this becomes really important, I think, when he wants to then talk about simples later and make the case, which I'm very sympathetic to, that there are larger wholes that are unbreakable simples that might have structure within them, like a word that has many syllables in it, but it constitutes its own whole. It's that kind of relation between parts and wholes that has to do with both difference, how I distinguish this from that, as well as I constitute a whole in which I make a cleaving that doesn't have attention to a lower level of this is and that. That has ontological consequences written all over it.
I think you can bracket out the ontological here. He's saying what's necessary to meaning and value for a sign. But he's not saying that this is all that's necessary. So he's saying that it's necessary that there's this differential system of sounds. But that doesn't rule out the possibility that the dividing up happens because of some relationship to the world that we have. He's not saying that it's necessarily arbitrary or willy-nilly.
He's not arguing against Grew and Bleen. Remember that discussion in the Nelson-Goodman paper?
Right, so
that,
right.
You know, why is green a natural kind and not green before time T and blue after time T? And that's what I'm calling
it. I really
time.
Think he wants to leave that alone.
It may be that it's essentially pragmatic / phenomenological, like an account of what happens and a willingness to say that this is how we make those distinctions. I mean, the way scientific distinctions are made. You make them and then you revise them later.
Yeah, it could end up aligning with pragmaticism, actually.
I think it does explicitly, actually, although I don't think Saussure deliberately did this. I just think if you look at some of, like, Peirce's linguistic writings, he ends up coming up with very similar concepts.
I see where the problem is. It's because of the disposition that ontology somehow means something eternal.
Well, he does seem to, at least, you're saying that when you have two different meanings for one word, that there's some ontological link between them. Whereas Frege was our representative, Gottlob Frege, for the analytic strain in philosophy of language, where Saussure is seen as similarly as the father of this continental strain. So go listen to our Frege episode if you haven't done that already. And Frege seemed to have a much more straightforward, when you have a meaning of a word, and clearly you could have different words with the same meanings, and he specifically gives table in French versus table in English. Those have the same meaning, which Saussure actually denies, because he thinks that the word in a given language,
they have the same meaning, they just don't have the same value.
They have different values because the surrounding words are not going to be the same. That even though table, you just have to look more closely at the language, that maybe we have different words for coffee table and different kinds of table. And maybe French just has table and covers all those things. And so that means that the words have a different value. And it seems for Frege, if there are two different meanings, I think Frege would just say those have different senses. So the same word can have two different senses, and the sense is hooked to a referent, something actually in the world, at least in sort of this ideal world. It doesn't have to be a physical thing. And so those are just different, where it seems like Saussure is going to say, because it's the same word, there's a connection there. And it's not just a matter of the history of the word, because we can't pay attention to that.
And that the difference between them is a difference of value.
Right. And the value being determined by the surrounding text.
Its place in the system is different. There are different words that are associated with it. It'll take place in different kinds of speech acts within the community. It'll actually serve a different, arbor and tree, let's say, will serve somewhat different functions for different linguistic communities.
Well, what about tree and tree, though? I'm saying tree meaning the branching thing on a piece of paper where you're sketching out the different...
Like a genealogical tree.
Yes, a genealogical tree versus an actual tree in the forest.
Yeah, they still have different values because of the surrounding context. I mean, because of the way they differ in the structure.
So let's clarify why they don't have different meanings.
Well, they do.
Well, those, I think, do have different meanings. They're,
all right, so just clarify what's the difference between meaning and value, I guess.
They're different signs.
Oh, so it's the same word, but a different sign.
Same signifier.
So they're homonyms.
A different signified, and so hence a different sign.
It's the same signifier and different signified, and the sign being a totality, anything that changes in that would be a different sign.
We should come up with a couple examples, one in which we have two words that have the same meaning but different values, and two words that have different meanings.
Well, he gives you mutton and, what is his example? Mutton.
And sheep.
This is on page 116. Modern French mouton can have the same signification as English sheep, but not the same value, and this for several reasons. Particularly because in speaking of a piece of meat ready to be served on the table, English uses mutton and not sheep. The difference in value between sheep and mutton is due to the fact that sheep has beside it a second term, while the French word does not. So you can see that in French, mouton is performing, let's say, all of the functions that you need two words for in English, and these are words that are connected within the system. So the values are different. The general concept is the same. And I think this is a difficult and much debated part of Saussure, because meaning and value are obviously intimately related. And arguably, you can say, well, don't the words then have a different meaning? Yeah, I think we understand the gist of what he's trying to get at. Which is to say, you can have these words which roughly translate to each other and refer to the same concept in some sense, or signify the same concept, but have somewhat different linguistic functions because of where they stand in the system and their relations to other words.
Yeah, and if you look at the next example, we'll get, within the same language, all words used to express related ideas limit each other reciprocally. Synonyms, and I'm going to use the English, dread, fear, and be afraid, have value only through their opposition. If dread did not exist, all its contents would go to its competitors. Conversely, some words are enriched through contact with others. The new element introduced, decrepit, results from the coexistence of... This only makes sense in French. So decrepit only makes sense in decrypt. The value of just any term is accordingly determined by its environment and is impossible to fix even the value of a word signifying sun without first considering its surroundings. So there you see the other distinction being where something could have the same value but not be the same sign because of a difference in the other end of the totality.
Now you're talking about the same value? Because he's talking about different values between...
No, but he explicitly says that dread, fear, and to be afraid have value only through their opposition. So they can have the same value, but may or may not, depending on how they function in a given sentence or structure.
So going back to mutton and sheep, same concept, translatable signifiers, but different values. So the sit in the sun example is nice. So when you translate a language, just because you can translate sun into its French equivalent doesn't mean it's going to do all the same things functionally and syntactically in French. You're not going to just be able to translate sit in the sun, take every word, translate it into French, and then have a phrase that makes sense in French.
No, it's the heart of the problem of translation, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Just to clarify this stuff on why he uses the term value here, this is just later on in that same chapter 4. He says values always involve something dissimilar which can be exchanged for the item whose value is under consideration. So in other words, like, how do we know the value of a penny? Well, what can a penny buy? And similar things which can be compared with the item whose value is under consideration. So we know the value of a penny by comparing it with a nickel. So that's the analogy. And then he says, think about that in terms of words, that there are similar words to any, right? So dread and fear, those are similar words. And then also that you can sort of compare what's the difference between dread and fear. Well, dread is maybe a really big fear or something like that. And then a word can be substituted for something dissimilar, an idea.
The way money can be exchanged for bread, the signifier, I wouldn't say word here. I think I've been using it too. It's wrong to say word exactly, but the signifier.
Well, this is him. I'm quoting him actually, but okay. You're right.
He's inconsistent and this is, yeah.
Right. You can say word for most purposes, but you got to be clear that there are some multi-word phrases that actually stand for one thing. So we just have to keep that in mind, that really we should be saying the signifier. Right?
The sound image. We're saying when we say word in those instances is the sound image, because word could mean the whole sign.
It's the understandable part of the language in a unit, and that changes an instance to instance. So, for example, just from the German, alles sausage, alles Wurst, which by itself doesn't make much sense, but altogether means something like whatever. So that's one unit. Alles Wurst is one unit. If you broke it down into smaller units there, you wouldn't understand it. So that has to be fluid. So yeah, the word is not correct.
Right. So isn't this is a point where he is quite different from somebody like Chomsky, who's focusing on the complexity of language and how we have to have certain genetic or evolutionary dispositions to be able to take something of this complexity in, whereas it seems most of what Saussure wants to say, and he explicitly brings in these, you know, it doesn't have to be a system of words. It could be any system of signals, right? It could be hand signals. It could be semaphore. It could be whatever. It doesn't have to have a whole grammar. And that still is going to have what he is going to characterize as essential to language, which is this just the sign, which is the signifier plus the signify, the signification.
Well, isn't it? I mean, you said something kind of provocative there, Mark, which is it doesn't have to have a grammar. But even on the analysis of the importance of difference, you could have a signifier and a signified that is a kind of brute force naming of something. But the way in which it's going to get anywhere past that kind of mere labeling is going to involve maybe not quite grammar, but something about difference in relation to its parts within the sentence, abstractly speaking, that it's involved with, as well as its context. And that is going to have, if not a well-developed grammar, it's going to have, again, a kind of implicit contextual carryover that allows it to actually communicate and not be a bunch of just gobbledygook.
Right. Doesn't he call it syntagmatic qualities?
Yeah.
Just the order of the words.
It will always have a syntax. It might not have a semantics. That would be how you would separate that out.
Yeah.
Well, in general, though, it's going to have both the syntactical relationships to other signs, the ways in which it can be grammatically used in a well-formed sentence, let's say, and then it will often have semantic relationships to other signs, like, for instance, dread and fear. So you have the two different constraints within the system, the semantic and the syntactical relationship.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about the difference. If you listen to somebody speaking a language that you really don't know at all, you won't even, as we've said earlier, won't be able to really tell the difference between words or sentences, except really on analogy with the way you do it already. And that might not actually correspond to the way they're actually using their language. And once you start getting one piece of it and seeing the context and the relation to other ones, that's the way you're going to both learn it and understand it.
Something I'll make this clearer is on page 122. Units and grammatical facts cannot be confused if linguistic signs were not made up of something besides difference. But language being what it is, we shall find nothing simple in it regardless of our approach. Everywhere and always, there is the same number of complex equilibrium of terms that mutually condition each other. Putting it in another way, language is a form and not a substance. So, for example, if you don't know the structure of a language, it is literally meaningless to you, according to Saussure. There would be no way to even approach it. This has epistemological implications, actually.
But it does bear out, right? You know, one of the reasons you can't figure out, what is it, linear B, is because we don't have a Rosetta Stone for it, and we don't have enough of it to relate it to itself to figure out what it means.
Right.
A lot of code breaking and cryptological work, you might not know what the exact code is, but you rely on the fact that somewhere in its internal relations, you're able to sort out what it means. This is the same thing with like game theory and stuff. And he, in fact, mentions it about checkers being a game just like language, having its own internal rules that you can sort out. And the reason why something like you would have a language that you could not sort out would be you don't have enough information about it. Or the other possibility, I guess, is it's just so different than anything you've ever seen that you don't have any way to any purchase on it.
Yeah. There could be an extremely complex function that translates one to the other.
Yeah. And it might just be too hard to sort out.
Yeah.
The reason I brought up the no grammar language, I actually had in mind this example that was in the lecture series I mentioned. Actually, Paul Fry was the Yale professor who did that. He talks about as a way of introducing semiotics, just the red light, stop, green light, go, yellow light. You know, that is a semiotic system in itself. Maybe that's just our way to transition from Saussure to other semiotic systems, because it's not going to have whatever is characteristic of a language for Saussure. It's not just that red and green mean these different things. They're also the sequence in which they're typically, we expect them to be shown, right? We expect the yellow to show up before the red. There's other things built into the convention. But still, you could just have one light. That's enough to tell you. You don't have to have the other expectations to have the meaning conveyed.
Or the blinking red light, you come in an area where there's no other light. It just blinks and you know to stop momentarily. Right. So yes, you don't always have to have all of a syntax there. I guess it can be implied, but not utilized. Because we still understand the red and green thing in a relationship to each other. So without a green signal somewhere, even if it's not visible in the light, that red doesn't mean what it means in that example.
And I guess you could say the same thing for any other sort of conventional signaling thing, right? We have a certain convention for what an exit sign looks like. So if you saw that sort of lit sign with that orange or whatever, you know, and you're in a foreign country and you see something and it's displaying, you would probably assume it's an exit sign, even though it doesn't say exit.
Well, now we're getting at symbols, which is not as non-arbitrary as...
Why wouldn't that be arbitrary? I mean, it seems that we have associations with it because of the language and we've seen it in...
Well, I'm thinking of an exit sign that if there's a visual marker of some kind on it that looks like what it's representing, that's symbol rather than signifier.
So like the fact that an exit sign in most countries is the same geometric shape regardless of the language on it.
Not just that, because that's still at the level of signifier. It's arbitrary. But I may be missing. Now I'm trying to think of what an exit sign actually looks like and whether there's a visual
like a stop
symbol,
sign
symbol, like a
or like a person crossing the road where you see a little stick figure. That's a symbol.
Yeah, well, that's a better example. The question of what's arbitrary and non-arbitrary becomes complex. It's an easy example when you have a stick figure that actually looks like what you're trying to say. And then that becomes symbol and is not simply a completely arbitrary signifier.
He talks about that in terms of language, too.
Yeah, onomatopoeia.
He talks about, right, and his response to that, like animal sounds, that even in different languages, you have different, you have cock-a-doodle-doo versus kikiriki. Mm-hmm. Like those, it's a conventional way that we interpret the natural world. And it's the same thing. Like if you showed what might be an obvious, like kids are crossing here kind of sign where you have a picture of persons crossing the road or something, and you showed that to somebody who's just in a savage land that's not familiar with signs or roads or any of that, like it's not going to make any sense. They're not even going to necessarily recognize a stick figure as representing a person. That too is conventional. Just all symbols are going to, even if they have some sort of, they're non-arbitrary.
But Saussure will actually make a distinction between symbol and signifier. It's not that everything ends up being arbitrary.
Those are the things that are only semi-arbitrary, right? Like there's still convention involved, but you can see where they're coming with it. Again, it's just like the animal noises. Like you can't say, we say cats say meow and the Spanish say cats say rah, or, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the main argument with onomatopoeia is that it's not really the way language works in general. Yeah. Some words work that way.
Well, it isn't one of the big point. I mean, this turns on the question of arbitrary. And it's like any discussion of difference, whether it's in mathematics or in this case, that if you say that the meaning comes out of the difference, it's arbitrary in the sense that where you put down one end of that difference is utterly at will or at random, right?
Yeah, okay. I think we're using arbitrary in two different ways here. There's the arbitrariness of saying that different sounds can signify the same concept. We can choose any sound we want to signify the same. That's arbitrary. And then there's the second level arbitrariness, the question of we can divide the world up in different ways and we can have different systems where pairs of signifier signified these signs with the same concepts have different kinds of relationships with other signs in different languages. And so there's an arbitrariness to the way we're carving up the world, or there's an arbitrariness to value, let's say. So those are two different ways of using this word arbitrary.
Yeah, and the arbitrariness of the sounds is going to become quickly constrained by the structure of the language, right? So as you accumulate more and more and you have the context of them related to one another, it's become more and more difficult to have the sounds be utterly arbitrary. In the example that Mark gave, you're not going to be able to maintain contextual meaning if you are constantly over and over and over again making new words, essentially, by having new sounds. You're going to have there be a kind of consistency in order to have it be a language at all.
Yes, yeah, so the most arbitrary level for Saussure is the letter, if we're talking about like language in the conventional sense. So like T and T, and this is an example he actually uses, is arbitrary. Like there's no reason why the crossed T and T go together. Now that's actually not true for every language. Korean, that's not true for, so that can throw it off, but Saussure didn't know that. That was a basic assumption, is that the most basic constituent unit was the most arbitrary.
Yeah, and I think, Dylan, what you're getting at is the arbitrariness is constrained to the extent that I can't suddenly, within the system, yes, dog could be used to refer to what we normally call horses, except dog is already taken. That's constrained even on a broader level, because I can't simply go around. This reminds me of an episode of a sitcom I saw once, I think it Sarah Silverman or something, where she tries to invent a new word and then goes around trying to make it infectious so that it'll become the new thing, like slang, some sort of slang word or something. And Saussure talks about this. Really, it's impossible. You couldn't legislate usage, for instance. You couldn't make a law and say, okay, from now on, we're going to use the word horse to refer to dogs and use the word dog to refer to horses. It simply wouldn't work. Again, for each individual user of the language, it's non-arbitrary, even though it's changing over time and things do change. It's just that no one particular person or government is going to be able to engineer the way we speak.
That's the heart of structuralism, right?
Right. The structure produces things, and once the structure's set, you can't really alter it. To use another example from Paul Fry, he talks about in China, supposedly, Madame Mao tried to change the signification of the red light and green light because red is the symbol for progress in communist China. So they tried to make red mean go instead of stop, but it didn't take.
That's awesome.
That's a great example. It didn't take. Surprise, surprise.
You know, you can see how you can start applying this in all kinds of metastructural ways, too, which is where this linguistic form of structuralism gets really both interesting and hard to deal with. You can see how much trouble we're having just figuring out the sign. Now, you know, talk about the mytheme, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that sounds like a good time to move to Levi-Strauss.
Yes.
All right.
It took me till about the second reading to figure out how this was really connected. Somebody else give a summary of the little essay. It's very short, called
Structural Study of Myth, which is from Structural Anthropology. He basically tries to set up what he thinks a myth is and to break it from a sort of arbitrary notions that it's had in the past. And he uses a similar distinction to Lang and Parole and then adds a third category. He sort of structurally lays out those categories. I mean, that's pretty much all he does in that example, when he uses the Oedipus myth as the primary example.
He says anthropologists don't talk about myths enough, that they've started to turn away from religion, and so that just leaves it to sort of idiots and lunatics describing this. People that try to say, what's the meaning of myth? And they just make up a bunch of bullshit. Right, here's a quote. Some claim that human societies merely express, through their mythology, fundamental feelings common to the whole of mankind, such as love, hate, or revenge, or that they try to provide some explanation for phenomena which they cannot otherwise understand, astronomical, meteorological, and the like. But why should these societies do it in such elaborate and devious ways, when all of them are also acquainted with empirical explanations? On the other hand, psychoanalysts and many anthropologists have shifted the problems away from the natural or cosmological toward the sociological and psychological fields. But then the interpretation becomes too easy. If a given mythology converts prominence on a certain figure, let us say an evil grandmother, it will be claimed that in such a society, grandmothers are actually evil, and that mythology reflects the social structure and the social relations. But should the actual data be conflicting, it would be as readily claimed that the purpose of mythology is to provide an outlet for repressed feelings. Whatever the situation, a clever dialectic will always find a way to pretend that a meaning has been found. So that sounds like, yeah, there is room for something else. And so he wants to give this sort of scientific alternative. But then the thing that he comes up with is so bizarre and arbitrary sounding, to me at least.
The table in the middle of that paragraph?
Yes. He tries to give an analysis of the Oedipus myth by saying sort of, what are the themes that are in Oedipus? And he puts them in a table and he comes up with these common, right? Some of them have to do with things being born from two parents, and some of them have to having the things being born straight out of the ground, right, from a single source. And it shows that the society was conflicted about this, that they couldn't believe that we were actually born from two parents. That sounds just as bullshitty as what he was just criticizing. So how is this structuralism? What the hell does this have to do with Saussure?
Well, it's an attempt to do a metastructural analysis, but I sort of picked this text to show how quickly it falls apart. Which is a little bit unfair, particularly with Oedipus, because you can hear in the first three paragraphs digs at things that we know are common. So if he picks the Oedipus myth and he mentions psychologizing, so he's obviously digging at Freud. But when you read his answers, you just go, the conclusions just don't seem to mesh. And you begin to wonder if these structures actually are as generative as they appear, right? That's what I immediately wondered. So, like, is the synchronic dimension actually meaningful when talking about myth? He talks about the obvious diachronic thing, the historical elements of mythology, which is important, but he makes a big point as to say it is both historical and not historical. Myth is a language. It has to be told. It is part of human speech. Therefore, it functions like speech. Therefore, we can structurally analyze it in the same way we can assign.
So what's the analog of grammar then? Because clearly you can tell the same story with many different sequences of words, and he gives different versions of the Oedipus as an example of this. So what's important here is the story then. It sounds like the way you said it, the comparison to language by just saying, well, but you have to tell it in language. Well, that's a pretty specious comparison. That's a point of connection with language, but then that doesn't mean that at the level of the story, which is what he's concerned with, which is supposed to express these timeless truths, right? He looks at the fact that different myths from different societies have so much in common, and that motivates this deeper structural analysis. I just don't know what to make of it. And I don't know if it's because we didn't read enough or whether it's ridiculous.
I didn't think it was ridiculous. I thought it was a very interesting analysis of the Oedipus myth, right? The myth has to do with the inability for a culture which holds up the belief that mankind is autochthonous to find a satisfactory transition between this theory and the knowledge that human beings are actually born from the union of man and woman.
Autochthonous being born from...
meaning springing from the earth, meaning yes, having an origin, an asexual origin. So there's this conflict between a... on the one hand, it's a kind of a childish, and this is well-established, children have to go from a transition from to understanding that human beings come from the sexual relations of two other human beings as opposed to just happening spontaneously, and that's an important kind of transition. And then in the myths of autochthonous, which are actually an important part of Greek mythology, it's really about the concept of a divine origin for man. And it's the same sort of conflict you will later see between, let's say, creationism and evolutionary biology. It's that sort of conflict, that sort of fundamental conflict. Now, how it relates to structuralism, I'm unsure. If I prepared more, I would have some sort of explanation for that.
In addition to being the problem of creationism versus evolution, it would be the whole relation of transformation altogether and whether or not things have an unchanging being and therefore you have to have natural kinds. Things are what they always have been. Or if things do transform, how do they authentically transform from one thing into something genuinely different? That's all at stake there, right?
Yeah, but I mean, there's some other fundamental assumptions that maybe aren't as obvious in that. One is Levi-Strauss sets up actually a deliberately sort of like Hegelian dialectical model in the mythine. So there's a dialectic between oppositions that creates the mything for Strauss. And that's actually more clearly stated in parts of structural anthropology that we didn't read.
Would that make it more clear how he actually assigns the different things to the columns in the table?
Having actually read that, I would say no.
Well, for me, I mean, it's clear in the sense it's just he's getting at these thematic elements, right? The overrating of blood relations, the underrating of blood relations. Is there anything controversial about categorizing these things as overrating or underrating? Or?
No, I guess what I mean is that it becomes very important what you chose to be the columns, how many columns you chose. That very act is establishing the structure that you're looking for.
Right.
So you're saying that somehow by looking at it, I find natural ways in which things break along and I look for a structure out of that. The way I look out into the prairie and I see grasses and I see trees and I see rocks and there's something kind of obvious or natural about that structure. And then I begin to look around at other things and categorize them and classify them in similar ways. And so in that way, it's perfectly sensible and legitimate what he's doing. But it also turns really importantly on how you end up making that cleaving and that association, whether you did it consciously or not consciously.
Yeah, that's vital, and it's really sort of muddled. So he does that along the idea you can break it up into mythemes, and the mytheme is always a certain thing. So I'll read the quote from Structural Anthropology that gets into this. Mythical thought always progresses from the awareness of oppositions towards their resolution or sublation. So you find elements that oppose or contradict each other through the structure, and then you find the elements that mediate that. He's assuming a Hegelian structure to the mytheme already.
The one thing we can see here, right, he's looking for, you can call it a structural isomorphism or an analogy, right? The overrating of blood relations is to the underrating of blood relations as the attempt to escape autochthony is to the impossibility to succeed in it. How is that related? Simply finding these similar relations between different elements of the myth. I'm unsure, as Mark is, how that's related to structuralism exactly.
Well, because he thinks that if these things are always there, that these oppositions sort of will necessitate certain readings across cultures, that these structures will just sort of emerge and produce certain things similarly. An example that he uses is he'll talk about the Native American trickster in different Native American cultures. He says that the trickster always has a contradictory and unpredictable personality, and the trickster is almost always a raven or a coyote. So the raven and coyote like represent an opposition between life and death. And he says that this is applicable like in several different, not entirely completely clearly related Native American societies.
So what that means is that the goal of this structuralism is to look for structural universals, both from one closely related culture to another, say different Native American tribes, as well as ultimately to all of human culture.
Right. I want to make it clear when we get to Derrida that this is one of the things that's underlying his whole critique.
Sure.
Because it's not clear that there's anything inside of these myths that would actually necessitate his assumption of a dialectical opposition that always makes up a mytheme.
Yeah, I mean, Derrida is going to deny that that structure relates to something authentic about the being of human culture, for instance.
Well, what's the, for Saussure, if we had to sum it up, we would say that meaning, or maybe more accurately, value is a product of structure, right? Unlike the traditional nomenclaturist, where any word can be taken individually and related to its meaning, we actually need structure to assign these values within the language. What is the analog here? In interpreting a myth, I know he's looked at structure in the sense of finding this analogy between autochthony and blood relations, let's say, and there's the structural isomorphism, but I'm not sure that that really exhausts the meaning. I mean, it's been useful. I think it's a useful tool here for the meaning, but it's not the same sort of thing.
Here's the assumptions, and again, I'm just limiting myself to structural anthropology for quotes. A really scientific analysis must be real, simplifying, and explanatory. And in the sense that Strauss, in structural anthropology, says he considers culture a system of symbolic communication, that you would have to analyze it the same way you do in linguistics. So it's not quite to the Derridaian, the world is a text, but it's all meta structures function like text. That's what the basic assumptions are.
I found another quote from Levi-Strauss. This is because I saw that the essay we read was part of this book, Structural Anthropology, from 1958. So I just looked that up. And I found a quote right near the beginning of that where he says he actually calls the founder of structural linguistics N. Trubetskoy. I don't know how to pronounce that. The illustrious founder of structural linguistics himself furnished the answer to this question. In one programmatic statement, he reduced the structural method to four basic operations. First, structural linguistics shifts from the study of conscious linguistic phenomena to the study of their unconscious infrastructure. Okay, so we've sort of seen that that's the kind of synchronic analysis that Saussure is going to do. Second is it does not treat terms as independent entities, taking instead as its basis the analysis of relations between terms. So we've seen that in Saussure. Third, it introduces the concept of a system. Modern phonemics does not merely proclaim that phonemes are always part of a system. It shows concrete phonemic systems and elucidates their structure. I think that's a quote from Trubetskoy. Finally, structural linguistics aims at discovering general laws, either by induction or by logical deduction, which would give them an absolute character. So that's at least how Levi-Strauss is seeing structuralism. And so you can apply that. So he's saying myths are not individual storytellers were coming up with these things. It's that the reason that they catch on, the reason that they spread is because they have this unconscious infrastructure, sort of like we talked about Foucault and how these power relations sort of are not localized to some monarch exerting these things. They're the sort of the society as a whole expressing these things. So we've got that in there. Now, I'm not sure what the analog to the irreducible complexity. So for Saussure, in a certain sense, the sign is irreducibly complex. It has the signified and the signifier, and sort of either of those bits by itself is meaningless. Like it's only even distinguished as a matter of contrast between the neighboring sounds and the neighboring concepts, on the other hand. But when you put them together, you can say something positive about it. Is that the dialectical character of the myth? Is that the analog here?
Yes, and there's another analog. And this is also in structural anthropology. If anyone has the book, it's on page 220. On one hand, one must seem that in the course of a myth, anything is likely to happen. But on the other hand, this apparent arbitrariness is belayed by an astounding similarity between myths collected in widely different regions. Therefore, there is a problem. If the myth is contingent, i.e. arbitrary, how are we to explain the fact that myths throughout the world are so similar? So he's saying that each element of a myth is arbitrary, like, say, the element of words, like the T is arbitrary.
The particular storyline varies.
Yeah, the particular storyline varies. It's arbitrary. But the structures are so consistent that there must be sort of a structural totality. And he comes to the conclusion that it's a dialectical totality.
As opposed to something like the Jungian unconscious or Freud's analysis of the society is, I don't know, he criticizes Freud, but it sounds like it's a Freudian explanation, this specific thing where the society can't deal with the fact that we're born from two people. And so this is a sublimation, a symbolic working out of that emotional problem that these people as a group have. That sounds like you're talking about group psychology and not about the structure of myth itself uprooted from its basis. I mean, that sort of seemed to be what I saw was the connection between Saussure and Derrida, is that both of them have this idea that language is this emergent phenomenon, that you can't understand it by looking at the sounds and you can't understand it by looking at the concepts. In fact, concepts don't even make sense apart from language, like we were saying before. I'm still not entirely getting how that works with myth.
Yeah, I can't say I get it either fully.
I'll be honest with you, to me, it's also sort of unclear. It always has seemed to me when reading Levi-Strauss that his methodology is imposed from the outside, which is what I think when Derrida critiques him of the center not being the center in the totality, like the center of the structure is actually outside of the structure. That's why, because the structure has to be imposed to make it make sense here.
Isn't part of the idea similar to other kinds of inquiries like science, like doing physics or mathematics, that the very fact that you have a structure that gets repeated over and over again and that it seems to be consistent and robust is a reflection that it relates to something actually there underlying everything?
Well, that's what Levi-Strauss thought.
That's all I'm saying, is that that's what Levi-Strauss means by structuralism.
Right.
That's what he is going after by looking at these different myths is looking for something that actually, as you said, ultimately gives you a dialectical understanding of what is underlying some aspect of existence.
He's looking for fundamental universal laws.
Yes.
But they're laws of myth, not of the psychology.
No,
right?
They're laws of humanity, I think. I don't think it's just laws of myth.
See, I thought he wanted to divorce it from psychology.
He wants to go more meta than psychology. He wants to say this is the way human cultures interact in this structure. So it's not other than psychology, it's psychology and.
Yeah. So the structures of myth in this issue with the trickster and stuff would be reflections, ultimately, of the way in which human beings are and fundamental characteristics reflecting human, maybe not psychology simply speaking, but psychology broadly speaking, the way Derek was saying. It's the big picture, the big underlying way the world is kind of thing.
I just found the quote. This is from The Raw and the Cooked. I had to go into a different book. If it were possible to prove in this instance, too, that the apparent arbitrariness of the mind, its supposedly spontaneous flow of inspiration, and its seemingly uncontrolled inventiveness are actually ruled by laws operating at a deeper level, if the human mind appears determined, even in the realm of mythology, a fortiori, it must also be determined in all other of its spheres of activity. So he's using myth because he thinks myth is one of the things that seem arbitrary to show that human culture has a structure, and it's a universal structure.
He thinks he's discovering the atom or the periodic table of human culture. Yeah.
So it's a linguistic model that's trying to approach something like we were describing in the structural realist earlier. Right? Because he thinks these structures are real in the sense that they are universal. It's actually in that way quite different from Saussure, even though he's using some of the basic assumptions about arbitrariness to sort of prove the point.
And the fact that these are unconsciously created.
Right. They're not supposed to be, they're not meaningfully related in that they were deliberately designed to look like this. So it's not like, say, Star Wars being based off of the Cambalan hero's journey. It's the generation of the hero's journey, etc. Although that's a different sort of structure, but yeah.
And isn't he taking, doing something like what we said that Saussure was trying to bracket, as Wes was saying?
He's unbracketing it.
Yeah, he's not explicitly being philosophical as much as he's taking those ontological and epistemological underlayment that we were pointing to that Saussure maybe wanted to bracket, and he's just running with it.
Yeah. Instead of just dealing with language, he's saying we're dealing with the way humans are. And the way humans are is like a language, so we can say these things.
And structurally, our languages are a sign of that.
Right.
And not to use sign exactly the way Saussure was using.
Yeah, it's just that if myth works this way and language works this way, then everything must work in a certain structural way.
I'll be satisfied with this if I can just get a little clear idea on how this approach differs from, say, Freud's. So Freud has these ideas of, we have these basic drives, and when you put people in a group, the drives are going to get us to react in certain ways, and we're going to sublimate, we're going to do all these things. You know, so he has these anthropological descriptions, like in the book Totem and Taboo, where he talks about ancient civilizations and how they develop strategies like the incest taboo and their ancient religious practices and things for dealing with really these fundamental things about human psychology.
I don't think he actually differs that much from Freud. I think he just wants to speak about larger structures. And this is why he's so tied into people like Lacan. Even though, I mean, Lacan wasn't using Levi-Strauss's theories, but it's the same sort of thing. If we can find these structures across the board, then we can say these structures are like universal syntaxes to human beings, and that they generate humanness. I think the criticism he would have laid at Freud is that Freud is just being too limited in his inquiry to the psychology.
Why even use the word syntax, a universal syntax? Looking at the way the word syntax is used in linguistics, it doesn't fit here at all, as far as I'm concerned.
Which word, Mark?
Syntax, right? The grammar, the ordering of the words. When you're talking, that seems to be exactly what Levi-Strauss is not concerned with. He's concerned with the story itself. If you want to say the story has a syntax, you're really stretching. It's a big analogy.
Well, I mean, maybe it's analogical, but is it that foreign to what you mean by syntax for a sentence?
Well, the syntax for a sentence are sort of, these are the legitimate orderings that the words can have in order for it to be a well-formed sentence. So
to be meaningful.
that's what is exactly what he's saying. You're discovering in the kind of structural analysis you're doing of a myth about these laws, about
themes, right?
The closest thing we can say here for syntax is that this analogy that he talks about, this relationship between A is to B is C is to D, those are relational. And it's that analogy or...
Levi-Strauss wants to go further than that. And that's what Derrida is going to criticize him for, is that all you can really talk about are those relations. You can't then point out of that into something absolute about the world. But Levi-Strauss wants to say you can do that, just like Marx does.
He's a realist. I mean, he's a realist in the sense that he thinks that there is something out there in which we are describing. Whereas Derrida would be using his same methodology to turn against him and say, no, you're not describing anything outside of itself. And when you do, the center of your structure isn't real. It's imposed from the outside.
Yes, let's shift to the Derrida. I think we've beat this Levi-Strauss to death. And Derrida will beat him some more. So,
one, you had mentioned Freud. I just looked up a little bit of Freud and structuralism, and there's all kinds of stuff about Freud being a structuralist.
When I was taught structuralism, I was taught the two proto-structuralists are Freud and Marx. Your major structuralists are Saussure, Levi-Strauss, Althusser, the Russian formalists. And then you have the questionable structuralists or the post-structuralists, the people that are a little bit harder to pin down, Derrida, Barthes, and Foucault.
Right, because clearly with Foucault, we're talking about some of the same like unconscious mechanisms, but he just doesn't use that language. He just doesn't talk about structures. He talks about economies of power. He certainly could use the word structures. I know he went through a phase of that, but I think he just didn't find that very felicitous, that verbiage.
He was reacting against Althusser, so yeah.
Not to reach too far, and you can bat me down if this is, sounds crazy, but this is reminding me a little bit of the kind of problem we had when talking about Husserl's phenomenology and the way in which it would betray its original stated goal of being phenomenological without looking to absolutes, and that especially in some of the later stuff that it would actually insist on reflecting something about the world in an absolute way. Derrida is ultimately going to make that same kind of criticism of the way in which Levi-Strauss uses structuralism as almost betraying itself.
Derrida definitely seems to be operating under the assumptions that he is not actually deviating from the methodology of structuralism. I think that's one of the reasons why that essay is so opaque, is he sees himself as using a structuralist approach to deconstructing structuralism.
So Derrida doesn't like the idea of even calling it structuralism. A structure always refers to some central part of the structure, some central idea, some organizing principle, some causal source, this essential core that provides wholeness to the structure. Because otherwise, why do you even call it a structure? If it's just a bunch of grains of sand in a bag, that's probably not a structure, unless you say, oh, but look, they all have this common molecular, you know, they're all sand. So that right there, you could say it's a structure, even though, you know, it's not configured in any particular way. But pretty much if you're going to refer to it as a group at all, and not just as a chaos, then you're bringing something up as sort of an unchanging part of it. And you think about the myth, I would imagine, he's going to say, if you're considering all these different versions of the Oedipus story, versions of the Oedipus story, then it must be because they have certain things in common, like the events which he puts on his table, I guess, which might not be in all the versions, but there's enough of them so that you could get those columns, he thinks, out of the dialectical opposition between some of the themes that come up, this overrating of familial structures and underrating of familial structures, etc. The initial thing why you might call a structure, which already does not sound like something that Saussure would be down with, right? Because Saussure says sort of it's entirely emergent. It's not that there's something on the idea side or something on the sound side that then creates language as its template, creates language as this organized thing surrounding some central idea. Like you might imagine a different picture of language where we see these rocks and trees in front of us and we say rock, tree, thing, and then we come up with adjectives to describe the rocks and trees, and we come up with adverbs to be more complex and verbs and things. And so ultimately the thing driving that kind of picture of language is the world itself as we experience it, this sort of pre-linguistic. But the whole point of Saussure is that's not the way it works. It's this arbitrary coming together of signs and signifiers to then create this system that has a life of its own. If Levi-Strauss is going to then have a picture of myth that has those underlying things, then he's missed the point, right? He's missed the arbitrariness that is built into Saussure.
I think what Derrida wants to do is to say that the bracket that Saussure put in, just because he wants to limit his discussion to linguistics, applies to all of life, because all of life is a text. We're only dealing with concepts upon concepts upon concepts and stuff. That's what all that talk about centering and decentering is actually about. Maybe I should quote.
Give the folks a flavor of the horrible language.
It would be easy enough to show the concept of structure and even the word structure itself are as old as the episteme, that is to say, as old as Western science or Western philosophy, and that their roots thus throw us deep into the soil of ordinary language. Nevertheless, up until the event which I wish to mark out and define, structure, or rather the structurality of structure, although it has always been involved, has always been neutralized or reduced, and thus by this process giving it a center or referring to a point of presence, a fixed origin. The function of this center was not only to balance or organize the structure. One cannot, in fact, conceive of an unorganized structure, but above all, make sure that the organizing principle of the structure would limit what we might call free play of the structure. No doubt by orienting and organizing the coherence of the system, the center of the structure permits the free play of the elements inside the total form. And even today, the notion of a structure lacking any center represents an unthinkable itself. So let's reduce that into something understandable in a sentence.
Well, the end of it made sense because that's just what we were talking about.
But it's the middle part that is thick. So nevertheless, up until the event which I wish to mark out and define, and he's very specifically talking about Levi-Strauss, structure, or rather the structurality of structure, so the form of structuralism, has always been involved and has been neutralized or reduced. So we don't talk about the structure of structuralism being hidden. Like, the structure of structuralism is a hidden assumption that no one ever brings up. It's not necessarily emerging from the myths themselves. You couldn't actually find that in every myth or something.
It's not read right off the data.
Yeah, it's not read right off the data. It's an a priori assumption.
He clarifies a little bit of this with this word free play later at the end of the article that we read. And he has the third to last, the second to last paragraphs, I think, help clarify this a little bit. He says, there are thus two interpretations of structure, of sign, of free play. The one seeks to decipher, dreams of deciphering, a truth or an origin which is free from free play and from the order of the sign, and lives like an exile, the necessity of interpretation. So that case is the case of Levi-Strauss. That is one interpretation that Derrida is pointing to, that he's assigning to Levi-Strauss. The other, which is no longer turned toward the origin, affirms free play and tries to pass beyond man and humanism, the name man being the name of that being who, throughout the history of metaphysics or of ontotheology, in other words, through the history of all of his history, has dreamed of full presence, the reassuring foundation, the origin, and the end of the game. The second interpretation of interpretation, to which Nietzsche showed us the way, does not seek an ethnography, as Levi-Strauss wished, the inspiration of a new humanism. There are more than enough indications today to suggest we might perceive that these two interpretations of interpretation, which are absolutely irreconcilable even if we live them simultaneously and reconcile them in an obscure economy together, share the field which we call, in such a problematic fashion, the human sciences. So Derrida, in the end, I think, aligns himself with the second interpretation he points to, which he explicitly calls more Nietzschean, in which it denies this absolute foundation altogether. He wants to say structure is not an indication of there being an outside.
Right. I mean, it's explicit. There is only text. There's not something outside of the text. There's nothing. It is truly arbitrary. The implication is also, for example, that the signified has no relationship to anything meaningful in the world itself. Not that it's bracketed out. We've said that Saussure brackets that out. He just doesn't deal with it. It's just not there for Derrida. There is nothing outside of the textual analysis.
I thought that the lesson out of this, which Foucault takes up too, is to end up denying Saussure's insistence on the sharp distinction between the structure of the system as it is right now and the historical backing of the system. Because if you say there's no center, really, so there is no single structure, so there are just various analyses of structure. Well, if you're going to make any sense, heads or tails of those, well, you can look at the difference between the elements, and then you can also just look at the history of how they got there. And those are the two ways you're going to gain insight on something.
I would say that Derrida is also rejecting the synchronic diachronic distinction, yes.
Well, so the question for me in all this is going to be that he's going to want to preserve the notion of difference and even preserve the notion of something like structure that you can even speak, but not want to have it refer and not want it to have it reveal anything outside of itself. It's that insistence on an utter lack of relation, going far beyond saying that, well, there isn't a direct correspondence or it's a murky relation, but to say that there's utterly no relation. That's where you might get a little bit up in arms, right?
All the scientific pretense is gone. That's what the Nietzschean thing is. There's no larger order outside of sort of structure and different. There's no corresponding relationship, and thus nothing universalizable can be said.
It just goes well beyond what a pragmatist would say, which is that that structure might be fluid, but that structure does, in the end, bear relationship with my experience in the world, because I acknowledge that that world is outside of myself, a kind of Humean acknowledgement, even if I don't understand exactly what cause is and all that sort of thing. I might muddle through. And Derrida seems to be going, saying, well, you're really hopeless if you're thinking that you're actually muddling through anything. And the problem there is that you don't seem to be left with any acknowledgement that there's anything that even faintly resembles, even if it isn't exactly something like cause and effect, or that I've gotten up in the morning, or it seems to be an utter abnegation of the notion that there's anything outside of myself, rather than maybe a complicated relationship between my individual self and things outside of myself.
There's a play on words here that might make a lot of the free play stuff make more sense. I wanted to backtrack to that just for a second because I feel like we're getting a little bit too meta. There's a concept from Levi-Strauss from another book called The Savage Mind, which is where he opposes a dialectic between the savage mind, which is the rules generated by game playing. I think I'm going to mispronounce the French because I don't speak French, but bricoleur. And then the engineer or the scientific mind, which is this very specific sort of programmatic breaking down. And so the free play stuff that...
I'm going to let you keep going, but I'm just going to insert right now that as much as I am incredibly sympathetic to someone like Nietzsche and even postmodernism, this is exactly where this kind of interpretation of the activity of science is just utterly wrong that they have. I mean, they're just absolutely completely out to lunch on this. That said, go ahead and explain what they mean.
Well, I mean, like, I think this is a problem that you can pin on Levi-Strauss, too, because it's a false dichotomy. But this whole bricolaire where, like, we're building up scientific systems and then building schemas. But that's not what the bricolaire are doing. The bricolaire is the savage way of building things up. And so we're building rules for the game, and the games are arbitrary, but we make the rules work by just agreeing to them. What Derrida is trying to do here is to sort of like apply one concept to the other and a means to undo it. It's that whole turn that he does. That's where the free play thing is mentioned over and over and over again. It's sort of a pun on Levi-Strauss's dialectic there.
He's employing deconstruction, even though we're not talking about it.
Right, exactly. He's pretty much saying that if you actually take the dialectic seriously, if you just invert it, everything falls apart.
I feel like I need to give the quote to clarify what bricoleur is.
Right.
He says somewhere in the middle, on the other hand, still in the savage mind, he presents what he calls bricolage, what might be called the discourse of this method. The bricoleur, says Levi-Strauss, is someone who uses the means at hand, that is, the instruments he finds at his disposition around him, those which are already there, which had not been especially conceived with an eye to the operation for which they are to be used, and to which one tries by trial and error to adapt them, not hesitating to change them whenever it appears necessary, or to try several of them at once, even if their form and their origin are heterogeneous and so forth. And he ends up approving of this, saying, actually, this is the way we have to, even though Levi-Strauss wants to contrast this with sort of the engineer who, I guess, getting right to the truth using the tools specifically designed for that. In other words, like doing this analysis of myth using this dialectical thing. Instead, we need to sort of just look at the history. Look how other people have analyzed myths and try this out and try that out and see what seems to work. And this all just sounds like very good pragmatism.
Well, it sounds like pragmatism, but it's like pragmatism against pragmatism. He's basically saying we should not even be so attached to having any sort of explanation at all.
See, the problem is that it really is just fetishizing destruction. So it's kind of a nanny-nanny-boo-boo intellectual activity. You sit around and you say, well, you say that you really figured something out, but I'm going to turn what you just thought of and show how you're full of shit. Without saying anything positive at all, and sitting around like a spoiled child trying to say, well, you didn't really do anything. You didn't really figure anything out because you really can't figure anything out. And willfully misunderstanding the activity that they're examining. And that's what's just utterly, absolutely infuriating. It is the nanny, nanny, boo, boo intellectual activity of the world. And it is just so pathetic. I can't hardly stand it.
In some ways, it's even more spiteful.
It's a very high level nanny, nanny, boo, boo, boo.
It is a high level nanny, nanny, boo, boo. Fine.
Because it's not just look at what you didn't do. It's also like, I'm going to do this the same way you did and throw it in your face. So, for example, the notion of the engineer who had supposedly been broken with all forms of bricolage and is therefore the teleological idea. And since Levi-Strauss tells us elsewhere that the bricolage is mythopoetic, the odds that the engineer is a myth produced by the bricolier. From the moment that we cease to believe in such an engineer and in the discourse breaking from the received historical discourse, as soon as it is admitted that every finite discourse is bound by a certain bricolage, and that the engineer and the scientist are also species of bricoliers, then the very idea of bricolage is menaced, and the difference in which it took its meaning decomposes.
It's that last part that doesn't hold up. I mean, this is where the beginning part says, well, look, the scientists have to understand themselves as pragmatists or bricoliers, right? What it comes down to is acknowledging that you're going to find some structure and going and then looking at that structure and saying, well, you know what? Actually, if you apply your idea about how this is fitting, you realize inconsistencies. And rather than taking that notion of realizing inconsistencies and using that to refine and come to understand, it just acts as a kind of high-level nanny-nanny-boo-boo that you are being inconsistent.
Well, yeah, I guess my response to it as a dirty structural Marxist, just to put my own philosophical baggage out there, is that it's instead of being willing to sublate the proposed dialectic, it just goes, eh, and stops. Instead of pushing forward to something new, it just goes, okay, well, you were wrong, done.
Yeah, I myself am much more sympathetic to the pragmatic elements of it because the pragmatic elements don't give up. They allow for continued refinement.
So did we just Derrida, Derrida? Because it sounds like we Derrida, Derrida.
We pragmatize Derrida. And I feel like going back and then doing that to Saussure as well. So, for instance, we said at the beginning, you know, one of his points is that it's totally arbitrary how you break out the sound spectrum into words. But clearly it's not totally arbitrary because of the limitations of our senses and our sense of time and things like that. So, yes, there are multiple ways you could have be a word, or you could have manaba be a word, but you couldn't have, you know, going on the next 10 minutes be a single word.
Well, he doesn't say that's, we're not that he doesn't kind of, make the claim that it's totally arbitrary.
I don't know if he uses the word totally, but he's certainly
arbitrary
says,
is used with a different,
it's used
he's
for
talking
the
about something else
part.
Entirely when he's talking about arbitrariness.
And it's also used for the constituent parts, not for, I mean, it's not even for the word that's arbitrary. It's like the letter or just the bass sound. Although the critique of Saussure, like linguists make, is that no, actually there is a relationship. So even, for example, there's been studies that have looked at the way letters are written and it said that what's done in Hangul, the Korean common script, where they explicitly based the shape of the letters based off the sound, is actually found in other languages pretty consistently. So it's not actually totally arbitrary that even like letters have symbolic representation.
Yeah, but I think Saussure, though, in dealing with onomatopoeia, it's not important that everything that it be totally arbitrary. It's just that it's arbitrary enough. We know that there's not a natural connection between some particular sound and some particular word. And we know that simply because there's more than one language. So that's all he needs for arbitrariness. Not like the sound horse is the only sound that we can use to designate the concept. So that's the arbitrariness. But as the other question, what I call second level arbitrariness, and Saussure doesn't really use the word arbitrary in this context. We have. We've used that word, but it's not Saussure's assertion. But the idea that we can carve up the sound, call it a spectrum or a, you know, and then the concept spectrum, and that they get carved up only when they come in relation to each other. Now, the question is whether that's arbitrary, whether the way we, let's say, construct the world or carve up the world is completely arbitrary. That's a question, again, I don't think Saussure really addresses.
That seems to be the upshot of why he was influential, is because he was interpreted that way.
It's definitely some of his success. Yeah, I agree. I think some of his successors take it there. Whether or not Derrida is saying that, I don't know. I can't help with Derrida right now. But yes, some of his successors took it to say, yes, it's arbitrary the way we carve up the world.
Right.
And there is only the text. Nothing is governed by any relationship to this external, mind-independent real world. Then you get the problem of relativism, and that's why I agree with that.
If I took your very first bracket off, then it seems like a lot of the critiques of Saussure by Chomsky and by, say, Koester and a lot of other linguists wouldn't apply. Because most of the critiques of him is that the base forms aren't really actually that arbitrary, that they're cognitively determined, and that there's underlying generative grammars.
I don't see where, at least in this reading, Saussure has said that. Again, he's saying what's arbitrary.
Well, there really is only this reading.
Are these sounds. It's not that there isn't some it seems to me consistent with what we've read, that there's some fundamental structure across languages. He doesn't seem to make an assertion either way on that. I think Chomsky and contemporary linguists are concerned with some different things in Saussure. I don't see exactly how they're inconsistent. You know, generative grammar is inconsistent with Saussure.
If I take Saussure to mean what your first statement, then I actually completely agree with you. I don't see how it's inconsistent either, but both his critics and his allies have taken him the other way. The thing is, it's almost impossible to know what he actually meant, because there's only really four works by him. The only one that's really complete is the one that we looked at, and it's sort of a cobbled together series of notes from his classes. I mean, it's notes from lectures not even recorded by him.
Yeah, and from what I've read, there's a debate on the extent to which contemporary linguistics is consistent with Saussure or simply is not concerned with the same things that Saussure was concerned with.
Yeah.
Because they really are, you know, I know you say he wanted to avoid philosophy, but I think there's a concern with a kind of epistemology here, which I think, and again, I don't know enough, but contemporary linguistics is abandoned to an even larger extent than Saussure, so I think they largely have different concerns, but I think some of the fundamental insights remain. This idea of the importance of a system and differences, say, for instance, the sum of the possible syntactical roles of a sign as being important to its meaning or value. As far as I know, that's a good insight.
I think if you take Saussure as the founder of semiotics and not linguistics, I don't think most linguistics would impugn on his role as understanding the nature of signs, not just languages, any sign, symbolic or otherwise. So, you know, I haven't seen Chomsky make a complete critique of the entire field of semiotics, to which Saussure is vital. So in that sense, yeah, I think you're right. I don't think we can read Saussure without the whole baggage of the way he's been applied in the 20th century. You know, maybe we should do that, but I don't know if we can. I don't think anyone else does.
Well, yeah, of course they do. Raymond Tallis wrote a book called Not Saussure. It's an extensive critique of. There are lots of extensive critiques of the way Saussure has been used and abused. I think we should acknowledge the way he's been used, and I think your critiques and Dylan's critiques are very important there. I just think from the text we've read, it's unclear to me that Saussure is committed to some of these things that his successors are committed to.
I see in the Saussure wiki page, it ends with a quote from a reference to John Searle. John Searle notes that in developing his deconstruction method, Jacques Derrida altered the truth value of one of Saussure's key concept. This is from Searle. The correct claim that the elements of language only function as elements because of the difference they have, differences they have from one another, is converted into the false claim that the elements are constituted on, Derrida, the traces of these other elements.
Right. This is also similar to Talos's critique. Saussure takes pains to say that signs as a whole, in fact, do have a positive value content. They're not simply differential. Each element, the signifier chain and the conceptual chain, derive their values from difference. But once they get linked up, then you get this positive element. And one of the critiques of the way Saussure has been used is that they seem to make the claim that signs as a whole only have their meanings or values as a matter of difference. But Saussure explicitly rejects that. They're not simply a matter of difference at the level of sign. It's difference at the level of signifier, difference at the level of signified, but not at the level of sign. And that's the way Derrida seems to make use of Saussure.
So Derrida misreads the totality.
Yeah, that's the criticism. I honestly couldn't say whether that's an accurate criticism. It's just...
I've read that structure, sign, and play text, I don't know, 40 times.
Oh my God.
Seriously, since it was a crucial text when I was in grad school. And I sometimes don't think I actually really know that there's a lot of there in all of it, because there's so much syntactical wiggling in the rhetoric, and there's a lot of throwing around Nietzschean or Heideggerian. And the shorthand is actually kind of a controversial reading in and of itself. So I don't want to say that I have a definitive statement of what this text means, because I've read it so many times that when I like insert a different interpretation of Nietzsche, when he throws that around, the meaning changes. That's one of the things I think that makes Derrida so beloved and also so impossible to deal with, because he's kind of like the Bible. You can superimpose a lot on him.
And it's filled with genocide.
Textual genocide.
If by genocide you mean the death of all meaning.
Yes, exactly. Extermination of all meaning.
I guess, you know, we're going to really upset the hardcore postmodernists because none of us are sympathetic.
I would qualify that to the extent that I am extraordinarily sympathetic to pragmatism. There's a lot of pragmatism that has in common with postmodernism. It's just that at the end of the day, there is more of a sense that you get more out of experience than your typical postmodernist line.
I'm an agnostic on, I would have to engage more with it before I could. My instincts go, it infuriates me to read Lacan and a little bit Derrida, but I would have to make a more serious.
I actually really like Lacan.
With Lacan, it's just the arrogance which comes across in the writing. It's an infuriating character that comes, anyway, so I'll call myself an agnostic and then just hopefully that will make some of our listeners feel a little bit better.
All right. Well, if listeners want us to do a separate Derrida episode, speak up.
This text is not really a good example of Derrida's overall theory. The only thing that's really, that he really like plays on that's used a lot in here is difference. This is the text that kind of made Derrida famous, you know, hyper successful in America with this one thing, and it also sort of killed Levi-Strauss's career, more or less, and Levi-Strauss was bitter about it till he died. Well, is he even dead? I think he died recently.
2004.
I remember when I was in grad school, which was around 2002, and we were talking about this, and there was interviews with Levi-Strauss, and he was still upset about it.
Actually, he died in 2009.
Yeah, but I thought it was more recent.
Yeah, because I thought he was like 100 or something when he died.
Yeah.
He was.
So crazy.
1908 to 2009.
Wow.
Man.
It's a long time to be bitter.
Well, apparently it keeps you alive.
Well, I think the person who lives the longest wins. So.
It's a basic empirical measure.
Derrida died 2004. 1930 to 2004. So there you go. But Derrida has better hair.
I saw Derrida lecture in person once.
Really? Was he understandable?
I was in call. Not really. He was charismatic and he was intense, and you could see why people gravitated to him. But I couldn't. I don't know that I was equipped to really understand him very well.
All right. Any other closings that have not already been spouted?
I think we broke every rule tonight.
No rules. We will not mention the rules.
It's probably a good
time.
Thing that we didn't, since we broke them all.
Well, in not mentioning the rules, we negatively gestured towards the existence of the rules, the background.
I think the non-adherence to the rules was defined by the trace of the rules left over from other episodes. We use those to make Derek prove his cred, but I know he's listened to this, so it was not necessary.
I think I've reviewed episodes before, actually.
Yes, that's how we came across you. So you go by, your blog is Ski Poet?
Skepoet. Skeptic Poet.
Skepoet. Not one who skis. No. I was unclear about that.
It's sort of an unfortunate name, actually. I just sort of stuck with it because that's what I named the blog originally. At one point in my academic career, I sort of reacted to listening to post-structuralist stuff in classes so negatively that I just became like a Michael Shermer positivist skeptic for about a year. We all make mistakes.
Skeptical poet. All right. Well, we'd like to link to some of your poetry online so people can marvel on that. Is it out there for the people?
Yes, it is. I can send it to you.
Would you like to recite something?
No, I would not. Yeah. But I have written some philosophical poems, but they're really bad.
Yeah. Well, I've noticed I tend to write lyrics like very aphilosophically. Like I want to express the gut. I don't want to overthink it. Or if I do, I make it a joke. I don't actually give serious philosophical account in lyrics. It doesn't make sense. Is that your experience with poetry?
Yeah, it is very. So I find that if I try to be a philosophical poet, it comes off as just didactic as fuck.
Well, that sounds like a good name for a band, Didactic as Fuck.
Didactifuck.
My blog is called Loyal Opposition to Modernity.
We will link to it. Folks can look there. We hope that you will also contribute some to the Partially Examined Life blog. Maybe we can get you to link to some things to help clarify parts of this discussion that were maybe not fleshed out as much as would be nice.
Yeah, I feel like our week together opened up more boxes than we actually answered.
That's all right.
That's a good conversation.
Well, but we're done with Saussure, at least.
You don't have to touch this again. You only have to touch structuralism when you go to Marx and Lacan.
Yes. Marx will come soon, at least.
For Lacan, I think we should read Bruce Fink. Not read any Lacan, actually.
For Lacan, you should read Zizek and just be done with it. No.
So I know your name is always listed as C, Derek. What is the C? See, that's not even embarrassing. It's not like someone else in the podcast has a secret C. Do you know who it is?
No.
It's C. Wesley Alwyn.
Yes, but I didn't intentionally hide my first name, which is Clarence. I'm coming out.
There you
I'm
go.
Come out as Clarence.
At last.
But I grew up being called Wesley.
I'm Jewish, so I thought being named Christopher was a little bit weird.
Derek with a CK is a common Jewish name?
No, my name is... none of my name's Jewish. I have a completely goy name, except for my last name, and even that's
so. Speaking of arbitrariness of signifiers,
you know, it's a Germanic name from Old English meaning Christ bearer, which is kind of fun.
Okay,
so he lives in Korea,
and I live in Korea, and I teach American culture, which I don't entirely know how I'm qualified to teach, except that I'm. Lived in America for 20 years.
You guys just watch Survivor episodes and stuff?
You know,
American culture, man.
We do all kinds of stuff in that class. But yeah, I am a PhD dropout.
Woo-hoo.
And still managed to get a university gig, I guess.
By leaving the shores of America, right?
Well, I was an adjunct professor in the States for a while, too. But that was starvation wages.
Yep.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
That's another
going
discussion.
Overseas is a way to go.
You going
to
flee west?
Well, a few years ago, I actually got offered a job in China to be a professor, but didn't bite on that one.
Okay. Next time, we will be talking about philosophy and race, featuring Law Ware from Oklahoma State University will be our guest. And so he has picked out things that he has taught in a course that he always says he's packed on this. Cornel West, A Genealogy of Modern Racism, an essay that he has. It's actually part of the 1982 book Prophesy Deliverance. And Martin Luther King's Letter from a Birmingham Jail and The Black Power Defined, two short essays. The Souls of Black Folk, Chapter 1 of Our Spiritual Strivings by W.B.E. Du Bois. And he also brought up Malcolm X's speech, The Black Revolution. There'll be many things on PartiallyExaminedLife.com to fulfill all of your desires. Donate money to us if you'd like. Go on the iTunes store, give us a good rating. Facebook, Twitter. Hey, we're trying to get advertisers. And to do that, we have a demographics form that you'll find linked from partiallyexaminedlife.com. If you do not mind, please go fill it out. So the people that want to sell you stuff through us will allow that to happen. Audiblepodcast.com/PEL is our sponsor. Check it out. Thanks, Derek.
Thanks.
Thanks, sir.
And good night.
Night.
Good night.
It's hard to slip it into words when you don't know what you're slipping for. 5 to 1, it's nothing new, but maybe we could use some more. Some will always seem obtuse when suffered on the outside. Still I die. Is it strong enough to magnify that empty spin that's in your eye? Is it big enough to justify the things it puts you through? Will you finally stop to stultify, or push your head and make it fly? Can you draw a map of where you'll die when you run out of fear? I think that time is near, but you never needed anyone enough to leave your hair undone. You'd stop it if it wasn't fun in some demented way. Don't know what else to say. We're running out of razor blades. If you want, I'll get some more. I think I'll have to bust a vein to give the pain you're asking for. I don't know what you want it for. Fall in my froward energy. File ye off to nowhere. Ache no more upon my tongue. Don't wanna suffer anymore. It's hard to slip it into words.